Hello, everyone, and welcome to this free episode of TF.
It's the free one.
There we go. I paused for him to say it. Being recorded from the past.
I mean, they're all recorded in the past.
This one,
relative to the listener.
The podcast that explains how linear time works.
Yeah, once again, we are explaining how linear time works because when you're listening to this, if you're listening to it on the day it comes out, Alice and Milo are both away because somebody didn't update the holiday tracker that we have because we are a legitimate business.
Wait,
that
what?
Happened sort of by accident.
There's a what?
There's a what?
Yeah. We are also very happy to welcome our guest. It's Gareth Davis from the Bureau of Investigative Journalism, who I think might be the most hated person of one guy. Gareth, welcome to the show.
I mean, maybe not one guy. There's probably others, right?
Say so, sure.
Yeah, no, thanks for having me on.
Yeah.
And we've also got him. He's here tonight.
Yeah. We've got Liam Kavanagh also calling in from an undisclosed location. Who's going to be providing valuable balance, where when Gareth says that he basically absconded with hundreds of millions of pounds of British public money, Mr. Kavanagh will be here to say,
No, that's bollocks.
That's right. So you've for the Bureau of Investigative Journalism, written a series of articles, and I'm going to lead us into it, actually, by reading a press release, not one of yours, from 2016. UK investor Rockfire Capital has acquired the 60.9 megawatt Swindon Solar Park in England from developer WeLink Energy. The plant, one of the largest in the UK, was built by British Solar Renewables in a site near Swindon in Wiltshire. It will provide a UK bank with renewable energy at a fixed price for at least a decade thanks to a 15-year power purchase agreement. Rockfire said the main investors in the solar park include Warrington, Newham, and Thurrock Borough Councils. They are among the first UK authorities to invest in clean tech bonds, it said, without giving any financial details of the deal. Rockfire Chief Executive Liam Kavanagh said, "We are delighted to have completed the successful purchase of the solar farm, and we have long been advocates of renewable energy and offer a range of ways for both institutions and individuals to invest in the sector, which has included the UK's largest renewables mini bonds that offers 6% returns." Now, Gareth, how amazing is this investment, and how can we and our listeners get involved?
I mean, if you read it like that, it sounds an incredible opportunity, right?
Too good to be true, almost.
It was so incredible that, you know, Thurrock Council at the time didn't tell anyone they were doing it until about 3 or 4 months after it was signed off.
And that's always the sign of a good deal, right?
Oh yeah, I mean, if you're going to, you know, make a load of money as a local authority and invest it and back in the services, all good news. You should not tell anyone.
Yeah, well, absolutely. That's because the voters in Thurrock, they're very focused. They're like, "You're Thurrock, stick to fucking Lakeside. Stick to what you do best. We've got the Into shopping centre. We've not got a John Lewis. We've got a Debenhams, RIP. We've got an House of Fraser. What else do you need? There's a Lakeland."
So very micro-targeted Essex.
We do have all those things. Thurrock is a big part of my and probably your life, Milo, growing up. It was a place of the future. I will be reminiscing a bit during this episode.
There's a big Costco.
It now may be a place of no future, unfortunately.
It's a shame. So we're doing sort of like origin stories, right? So like we did a Bromley-focused one with Captain Gatso.
Yeah.
And now we're going into Essex and we're doing Thurrock.
The investment sort of prospectus press release I talked about, this, as you sort of perceptively say, seems too good to be true and such a good investment that you would invest in it and then frantically try to cover losses from that investment with other investment, which I hear is an amazing strategy for roulette.
Yeah, and I
assume it applies.
Because if you throw good money after bad, what happens is that the good money sticks to that bad money, and it kind of like gloms together in a big heap that then you can just like pull back out with your hands.
Yeah. It's like the old trick where you tie a coin around your finger and put it into a vending machine. That's what you can do with throwing good money after bad.
So
why I read that press release is that recently, I think a lot of this stuff has come to a head. Where I'll sort of try and summarize this, and Gareth, you can tell me what I've missed. This firm, Rockfire Capital, owned by Liam Kavanagh, this fellow, has now gone out of business, and it has now come to light that a number of UK councils have lost hundreds of millions of pounds that has essentially gone into the pockets of this one guy, and all around this idea of councils investing in clean tech bonds, quote unquote, related to these solar farms that were actually not amazing. Is that kind of a fair summary?
I mean, you're probably being slightly unfair to the solar farms, actually. They are, in itself, it wasn't a Ponzi scheme. These things existed. And while, you know, while all things are good, they actually made a bit of money for the council. I think it's ultimately a story about how in local authority, this one guy, you know, this council officer, kind of got in too far over his head. You know, so for a few years, I mean, there was always an issue of not telling people what they were doing with these vast sums of their money, but it not really being qualified to know, you know, how it's qualified to invest all of this stuff. But it really came to the real problem is when they started investing beyond simply giving this guy loads of money to buy solar farms, when there weren't any new solar farms involved, and he just simply came back and asked for more money, and they inexplicably handed it over.
Well, because that's the solar farms guy. We assume he's got more of them somewhere, you know.
He's growing the sun.
Yeah, that's the guy who turns the sun on in the morning and turns it off in the evening, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah.
So, just like inadvertently reinventing like a sun cult in Essex just on the back of like one council officer.
Well, the thing is, in Farrakh, we follow a sort of pre-Socratic philosophical methodology. We kind of believe in the work of Heraclitus that, you know, the sun and moon exist in a kind of dichotomy. One bids the other good evening and sinks below the Earth's horizon. And then the other appears and they, you know, they live in the same house and they do opposite shifts.
Yeah, this guy goes to Tharic Council and is like hailed as Apollo or Ra.
Yeah.
Liam Kavanagh is building himself a great pyramid in the middle.
Oh, he's built a pyramid, all right.
So, yeah, it has a Debenhams in it.
Yeah. The Debenhams Pro Shops pyramid.
So, what happened, as we sort of alluded to, is that. The councils, mainly Thurrock, but then Thurrock bought a number of other ones in, was going to fund the construct the sort of operation of this solar farm outside of Swindon. And then, as you alluded to, Gareth, Kavanagh from Rockfire Capital went back to Thurrock to then buy like 50, 55 sites across the UK, paying out a total of £655 million, £138 million of which is now missing. And Thurrock did... And as Thurrock led a kind of investment consortium, almost like a like an Avon situation of investment in these sites.
I think it's even worse than that, really, because initially it was Thurrock and a few other councils, but you know over time it really was only Thurrock left in the game. They took over all the other councils' investments up to a point it was about £500 million, and then it was this this stage where he's managed to convince Thurrock to give him all this money to buy these solar farms, and he wants to know how to make even more money. Knows that he's talking to someone who is open to it, susceptible, gullible. Goes back to him and says, "Look, there's no new solar farms here, but you put more money in to these bonds, you get more money out. So give us £50 million."
And so, if you're another council, if you're say Warrington Council, and you're in on this. You don't have to be sort of like less gullible than him. You just have to be less gullible than Thurrock Council. And so long as you can do that, they will they'll pick up the tab for everybody.
That's what they did. I think at a certain point, Warrington decided to get out, to sell up basically. And Thurrock was more than willing to take their share.
So I want to talk a little bit about, some of the people involved and the mechanics of what actually went on before getting sort of deeper into Kavanagh, what he did with the money, and so on and so on. So,
I assume only good things.
Yeah, of course. You actually invested it in services in Thurrock more effectively than Thurrock itself would have.
We privatized all of Thurrock Council and created a kind of like Apollonian god king over there.
I'll tell you what, you should see the way he's renovated the Foot Locker. I've never seen it so good.
So, before we get to Liam Kavanagh, long-term listeners of this show will know that wild financial schemes like this often just depend on one guy.
Sometimes an Australian man.
If you recall Greensill, we talked about Greensill for years, And then sort of almost were sort of amazed towards the end of the saga when it turned out that how much of what Greensill managed to do really just depended on one Australian insurer being like, yeah, okay, I'll write that risk. Mm. And then when he was fired, Greensill collapsed.
Yeah, a man who was later quoted as saying, oh no.
But in this case, our one man
Struth Cobber.
Our one man is Sean Clark from Thurrock Council. So tell me a little bit about Mr. Clark. How did he come to know Kavanaugh? How was he put in this position where he's managing a like hedge fund amount of money, but like as just a guy?
I mean, he's Sean Clark, he's the chief financial officer of Thurrock Council, which is a kind of each local authority has to have someone in his position. They call it, you know, if you want boring council talk, a Section 151 officer, it's a statutory position.
Yeah.
He's the guy who kind of manages the council's finances, not an elected person, you know, a council official, a member of staff, a very senior member of staff at the council. He gets put in touch with Liam by Warrington Council. They've done a bit of business with Rockfire and Liam, and noted that Thurrock had a director of finance who was, you know, wanting to bring in, try new ways of bringing extra money. And the kind of, you know, as you kind of recall, we were, you know, we still kind of are in the completely in the mire of austerity, local authorities' budgets being cut, their ability to raise money in kind of non-risky ways or standard ways is quite restricted. Mm. Council tax increase caps, you know, business rates are variable. So he's looking to bring in extra money. This guy's, you know, he's got some, you know, qualifications as you might expect, but nowhere on his CV has he managed an investment portfolio in excess of, you know, £500 million, as you'd be not surprised to hear.
Well, and he wouldn't be for long, as it turned out.
But it's not just that, you know. See, he also comes across this genius idea of, you know, it's not just wanting to do the investments. You've obviously got to find the money from somewhere. And I think most listeners would wonder where on earth a local authority, a cash-strapped local authority, managed to find £500 million. In fact, far more than that. And, you know, you've actually an incredible situation where he borrowed it from other councils.
Oh, my God. Sorry, this just isn't even a country anymore. This is just like 100-something councils handing around the same money.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it didn't matter to them where the money was going because he was paying them back by borrowing from other councils. So it was a perpetual state of, you know, borrowing from Peter to repay Paul. We're talking like tens of millions of pounds on month-long loans. It's an insane situation. Absolutely bonkers.
This is Sopranos stuff. All the councils are sitting around in the back of the pork store. They're like, you need money? Talk to Paulie Shropshire. Yeah, I'll give it to you. 4% vig. But I want those bags full on Friday nights.
So this works, I guess, so long as the money never stops moving. And the money can then stop moving by the expedient of, what, anyone asking any questions about this?
Well, you think, but I write about this for 4 years. A lot of questions are asked, and it took a lot of those questions for someone to start, you know, actually paying proper attention. But yeah, once the house of cards starts, and once one card is taken away, it all starts to fall, and that is ultimately that leads to the collapse of the council. Because when we write these stories about the ridiculous ways in which this money is being used by Mr. Kavanaugh, council's finally cotton on and have warned to stop lending money to Thurrock, and the business model that
he's a degenerate fucking gambler.
that Sean Clark has created, this turned him, well, briefly turned him into what was heralded as, or he heralded himself as the savior of Thurrock Council. It collapses, and you find yourself in a situation you find it now, which is one of the biggest scandals in local government history. Local services on its knees, people facing, you know, decades of tax increases. And yeah, all because of the, you know, the risks and the hubris of this one individual, or of course, and the man he did business with.
They're busting out Thurrock Council. They're going into the schools. They're selling off all the chairs.
Yeah, all of Thurrock
is... if they're having to, like, these sort of, like, austerity measures, the sort of, like, local government bankruptcies, which, you know, Birmingham's about to enter, they're not nice, you know?
Mm.
It's I think it's also worth asking now, even before we sort of go into the character of Kavanaugh.
tearing all the chairs out of the schools, and the school just collapses because it's made of really weak concrete. Actually, a load-bearing chair. You
know, the schools all burn down under mysterious circumstances. Just like,
we'll
These schools seem to have a lot of ignition points in their fires.
I could absolutely believe the Tory government setting fire to Britain for the insurance money. That is a plausible way out for them.
So I think before we go into Kavanaugh as well, I think it sort of fits with talking about Clark is, well, why do councils? It's worth asking, like, no other, as far as I'm aware, there's no other country that has its local government engaged in gambling to fund schools and bin collection. Okay, well, yeah, maybe Monaco. Well, Monaco doesn't put it on black. It is the house.
Yeah, they are the house. Like, yeah. They tried to do the thing of funding government from gambling revenue, but like, as a gambler.
Yeah. Come on, yeah, just one more roll.
We've gotten a guy who plays 40 games of Poker Stars online at once to be our new finance officer. Mm. No, but this is true. There is no, as I'm aware, like, Canadian municipalities don't fucking do this. You know, in Canada, in the States, it's more ordinary for municipalities to sell bonds, right? And then pay them back with tax revenue or with central government money. And then to invest in things, maybe investing in things that are inside the boundaries of the local area in order to, say, own their own facilities. Mm. But the idea of that's, again, this is not just Thurrock. This is lots and lots of councils. Right before COVID, went on a huge shopping spree purchasing office and retail properties.
Yeah.
Like, just, you know, if you want to know who the exit liquidity was for, like, I don't know, Brookfield owning some dead mall in Croydon, it was most likely a British council, which is great.
Excellent. Yeah, because it does sort of raise the question, if you've got 500 million quid to spend of other people's money and you want to own a solar farm to get the returns, why are you paying some guy to build? You could just go and buy a solar farm.
Yep, that's a good point. I mean, that's what Warrington eventually decided they were going to do. Don't give the money to him anymore and get in the business on their own. I mean, trying to get your head around the rationale behind this stuff is pretty impossible. You've been doing it for several years and, you know, not helped by the fact that, you know, the guy himself, the people involved, they don't want to talk. They don't want to explain this.
How surprising. This.
There's no document in the public domain, as you would expect when a local authority spends, you know, £600 million explaining the rationale and the risks involved. Mm-hmm. It was, you know, they wouldn't even release this stuff under the Freedom of Information Act.
And, well, what I was saying is, do you know who falls for, like, too good to be true deals is desperate people. Because this is not the first and will not be the last tale of a council that gets into a situation like this because they need to start gambling to cover their bills. So I did a little more just for context. You know, this is ever since like the late teens, 2020-ish, Parliament has been sort of concerned about local councils' investment activities. Mm. This is from the Commons Public Accounts Committee. They say that there's concerns that councils have exposed themselves to commercial investments, which risk cuts in local services and a big bill for taxpayers for no return. Where financial pressure on local authorities' budgets combined with long-standing encouragement to invest in commercial enterprises to bring in income. So this is basically the Tory answer to austerity, which is...
Yeah, I was going to say, like, encouragement from whom? This is like sort of a serial killer taunting the police.
Yeah. I was going to say, Tory MPs being concerned about the investment practices of local councils in the UK is quite a lot like Pablo Escobar being concerned about cocaine consumption in Miami in the 1980s. Like, it's sort of like,
They say that new debt taken on by councils has ballooned commercial risky investments in commercial property by 14 times between 2017 and 2020. Risky investments in commercial properties from 2017 before COVID, when these things were highly overvalued, it multiplied by 14. This time bomb, I think, is just beginning to explode as well.
Oh, good.
And this is just an example with an extremely flamboyant and weird character at the center in the form of Liam Kavanaugh.
Well, let's hope it doesn't go off near any schools because they'll fall right down.
Yeah. So they say that this is because between 2010 and 2020, central government grants to local councils have reduced by 40%, but demand has only increased. So of course you're going to gamble because your income is fixed. You can't find any other money. Demand for your service is increasing. And across the political spectrum, everyone just looks at it and says, I don't know, have you considered automating something, reforming, or bringing in the private sector? Like, of course they're desperate. And of course,
selling off your parks.
Yeah. And at the same time, they've got to look after the most vulnerable people in society. They can't turn around and explain why, you know, why they can't provide special educational needs provision, or why they can't look after adults with learning disabilities. They've got, you know, that's a statutory duty. Those people can't go without. And so, yeah, that when they don't have any other option, it's inevitable that, you know, some local authorities are going to take that risk. I mean, I put forward that Thurrock doesn't perfectly fit this, kind of explanation because of local councils. They were not as far, anywhere near as far down the line as this. I think this is as much an exercise in wanting to appear to be clever and to have come across a solution that others hadn't. I think if you kind of look through the way in which the Tory council, their councillors, responded as, you know, concerns were raised about what they were doing, this wasn't a, you're right, we need to look into this, but we had good intentions, we really need to make sure these services are well provided. This was, we're going to laugh in your face and you don't know what you're talking about, and the only thing we're worried about is someone's going to come and poach our brilliant director of finance.
Oh, fun. I'm kind of curious too about what the oversight for this is like. Is it A, meant to look like, and B, in this case, as you kind of hinted at, like, actually shook out?
Basically, you know, councils basically police themselves these days.
Oh, cool. Okay.
There used to be an audit commission, wasn't perfect. It was, torched in the bonfire of the Quangos back then by Cameron. And the local audit system isn't worth the paper it's written on. They're overworked, underpaid, don't really give a shit. And so it's left down to local councillors. And, you know, there are some exceptions, but largely they are, you know, at best underqualified, at worst utterly and totally useless. And as they were in Thurrock, their jobs were to scrutinize what Sean Clark as director of finance was doing. And you had these individuals standing up in council meetings and actually stating, oh, it's not our job to check how council officers spend our money. So that system that was supposed to be in place, those checks and balances, utterly failed. And if you go to, if you push a bit further, and you go to the government, what did you do? And they'll say, well, you know, ultimately, accountability at a local level is about the ballot box. You know, if people don't like what, their council's doing, they'll vote them out. But of course, if people don't have the foggiest what their council is doing, because, the council doesn't abide by any sort of transparency rules, they hide everything that's going on, how on earth are they supposed to vote them out?
Well, not very helpful to vote them out after they've robbed the place either.
Yeah. Well, it's also kind of a producer's situation because local councils benefit from being in possibly the most unsexy arm of government to the extent where no one is interested in what they're up to. You rely on paid professionals being interested because people in the public sphere are not going to be interested.
No one was interested in this story for the 2 years that I was writing it until Kavanagh starts buying his jets and his mansions and his crystal chandeliers,
I was going to say that, like, there's a lot of council, like, as you sort of alluded to, like, lots of councils are kind of in this position. And one of the things that was, like, one of the interesting bits of what I was thinking about while I was reading your investigation is really this, like, broader political context of, like, council sort of being told during the austerity years that, like, you know, you've got to think of innovative ways in order to kind of run and to function and to provide services. Like, Croydon's a really good example of, like, where the real impacts of this are being spread out. And so the point you made about the council's not being transparent because their understanding is that voters, if they don't like what the council's doing, they'll sort of vote them out. But that runs contradictory to how councils are sort of supposed to be perceived. By which I mean, like, is there sort of, like, broader political impetus that, like, for a good council is one that doesn't, quote unquote, like, waste your money, right? And so if a council is being seen as, like, saving money by making efficiencies, by investing, like, externally, then actually, like, they can use that to politic. And I wondered what your thoughts were on whether like incidents like this can happen because you have a much broader political system post austerity has been one which measures the effectiveness of councils not on the types of services or how many of these services they produce and how many people benefit from that, but whether or not they are sort of quote unquote like value for money.
Yeah, whether they're keeping the lights on. You know, I think while this seemed to be working, there wasn't a great clamour from the public or from opposition councillors to really scrutinise what was going on. And, you know, for the local peoples, I don't blame them. You see, they would have been seeing stories across the country of you know, really key services being cut, buildings being, libraries being closed, children's centres, disappearing. And, you know, think, oh, that's not happening in Thurrock. It seems pretty good.
So I was going to say, that's the other thing too, like, as it sort of trickles down. So, like, there are where sort of austerity begins, like, you know, it's really hard to sort of notice, especially in places like Thurrock, where I can imagine, you know, there are lots of people who are homeowners who are like Tory voters. And so those issues don't really sort of kind of become present until really just around about now when you notice that, oh, like the roads are not in good condition and there's like, you know, things just don't function. And these things that like were always kind of issues before, now they've degraded so much. And now the council is sort of saying that like, we can't actually afford to do these very basic things. And in this situation, because a guy has like swindled them out of all the money that they've got left.
So I want to go on just to one more sort of thing before we get to sort of Kavanaugh and how the actual deal worked, which is, you know, what we've been talking about, councils, council officers. These are people who are frequently paid, I don't know, 30, maybe 80, like 80K at the top. 80K is a lot of money. But the people who are paid to actually manage investments tend to be paid millions of pounds a year to manage investments. They tend to have large teams. They tend to have Bloomberg terminals. And so what essentially has happened is the central government created a need and an incentive for councils to start investing like they are asset management firms.
Mm. Yeah, however, just run your own private hedge fund on the cheap.
Yeah.
Use people from the town.
Yeah. Well, the
this
council
guy has
they,
a business degree.
They trim a lot of hedges, so why not become a hedge?
Right, but the actual people, like the people who, if you want to run a successful asset management firm, you need to pay a large group of people gigantic amounts of money.
You need to be some kind of like extravagant Tory sex criminal. Like that kind of thing isn't available to like most people.
And even a lot of them turn out to be Ponzi schemes in the end.
Yeah.
But you're essentially, what you're doing is you're expecting, you know, Bob from the council to be able to smell the kinds of things that like sharks at hedge funds are supposed to. So of course, if you want to go after big easy money, then of course you're going to go to councils because they're staffed by people who aren't paid enough to see through any obfuscations that you might put up in front of it. You're not going to get fucking like, I don't know, the hedge fund from The Big Short to invest in Liam Kavanaugh's solar farms, basically. You know what I mean?
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah. But the good news is there's tons of councils who have a ton of assets because they run all the stuff. And, you know, they're all ripe for the picking. So,
So if anyone's listening to any of those councils, consider the Trash Future Patreon.
Yeah, that's right.
Great rate of return.
Yeah, we can save you for £5 a month with this, piece of financial advice. We can save you upwards of like hundreds of millions of
pounds. We're kind of like the scam checker. Like, if you listen to us regularly, you'll know about the flim flams that are going on in your area.
We could have gotten you out. We could have gotten the government out of Greensill early. So let's talk a little more about
that's the
Kavanaugh
thing, though. That's why they had to like do it in secret, and that's why they had to like have this sort of cloak of obscurity and boringness to it, is because like there's a lot of people who I think would be able to look at this and go, well, hold on a second, why though? Like, I have some sort of some hesitancy about this.
So I want to talk a little bit more about Kavanaugh himself. Like, where did he come from? What was he like? How did he sort of come into this business? What is he like as a character? And I'm also interested because we keep seeing this again and again and again. I think Lex Greensill is the same type of person. This economic agent, this class of person, sort of in an economic sense. Tell me a little bit about sort of Kavanaugh, how he came to get into this business.
Well, you know, he, prior to doing, he's solar farm deals with the council. He'd had no previous experience of doing, you know, renewable energy deals at all.
Something he had in common with his investors.
Pretty much. You know, he was, I mean, he kind of, there's a recording of him getting driven by his PA to his publicly funded private jet that was leaked to us. And you can kind of tell the man where he's come from this conversation that he's having with her. He's, you know, he doesn't believe his luck. He's saying, like, you know, 10 years ago, we were sitting in a fucking car park, smoking a fag, you know, basically average Joe kind of stuff. And then, you know, fast forward all that time, he's suddenly, he's got this, you know, palatial mansion in Hampshire. It used to be one of Jane Austen's favourite haunts. He's got a place in Dubai, he's got a private jet, he's got two yachts. So before Thurrock, you know, he'd been involved in a few investment schemes that hadn't gone particularly well, sort of shrouded in a bit of mystery. People we've spoken to about it weren't particularly keen to talk about him. I think he takes an advertisement out in the FT. Looking for public funding for his, you know, to create a solar farm empire via these bonds that have got good returns.
The first time he would appear in the FT, but not the last.
Not the last.
Area man seeks rubes.
Mm.
I doubt he even thought, you know, in his wildest dreams that initial deal that he did with Warrington and then later on with Thurrock and a couple of other London boroughs would eventually see him, you know, amass this empire of solar farms, all bought and paid for by the taxpayer. So he's a fairly unremarkable story, really, up until the point he gets involved with Thurrock. Mm.
So it's in that when we talk about this guy as like an economic agent, what they all have, and like Lex Greensill had the same thing, is an understanding that nowadays. The Britain especially, the way to get rich here, what we do is middleman things.
Mm.
We own them, we buy them, we sell them, we cut them up into tranches, we securitize them, and so on.
And crucially, short cons. You do this for a while, you do this for a few years, and then, you know, maybe it goes wrong, maybe it doesn't. If it doesn't, you keep going. And if it does, you just fuck off to Dubai, you know. Or Lex Greensill, you retire to your sort of country estate where you played the most dangerous game.
Yeah.
And even then, like, it's not necessarily even accurate to say cons, because what's remarkable is that even if sort of the values of some of the solar farm properties may have been overstated, it doesn't seem like Liam Kavanagh actually broke the law. Like, he did something, in fact, the kind of thing that he did is implicitly or indeed explicitly, in terms of these local governments being encouraged to essentially gamble with the school budget, you know, this is, he just stepped up and filled a quite legitimate role that only happens to be ruinous for everyone involved except him.
I mean, you do sound a bit like his lawyer.
Yeah. Riley, I mean, has that talent.
That is the point that they put across, you know, and they're, you know, in some cases I can see an argument for it. I would put forward that, you know, deliberately inflating the value of something that you're wanting 50 million, 130 million pounds for is, you know, in some interpretations, fraud. So I do think there's a very strong possibility that this isn't all lawful. But certainly there is enough, you know, there's enough uncertainty or enough of a grey area where he feels like he's been able to do this and get away with it. And, like, you know, so far, the authorities, aided and abetted by Thurrock Council, that has spent years denying that anything was wrong, and then the preceding period, you know, doing everything it can not to say that it's been a victim of anything. Now, certainly that has helped, you know, strengthen this idea that, you know, actually, you know, it's pretty legitimate. That he didn't really do anything wrong. He played fast and loose, but ultimately the errors, the mistakes are Sean Clark, the director of finance, and Thurrock's, and there's definitely it's definitely true. But yeah, I'd come back on the point where I do think that there's strong, very strong evidence suggests that there is some, you know, something unlawful, allegedly, I should put allegedly. I mean, it's probably difficult to to recognize this without knowing kind of what goes on behind the scenes when it comes to producing journalism like this. But that intro that we put for the last story, and I'll just read it out for clarity's point. Mm. A rogue businessman appears to have cheated a council in Essex out of as much as 130 million and spent the money on a life of luxury in potentially the largest fraud ever committed against a UK local authority. The level of work and evidence that goes into getting a statement like that in print is colossal. And it proves we have a team of very kind of, you know, diligent lawyers and fact checkers. We wouldn't be, you know, publishing that with a very, very strong evidenced belief that the law has been broken. But I do think you're right in the sense that there is a kind of wider point about individuals like this and the creation of the circumstances where people like this individuals can take advantage of the situation, and then therefore be enough of a grey area to think that they could get away with it.
So, and what I was also referring to as well is him saying, look, I bought all this, these private jets, I bought this collection of guns, I bought this dinner plate size jeweled Hublot. and all of that was fine because the council is not responsible. I'm not responsible for the council's due diligence on how I spend the money. And it's things like that as well.
Yeah.
Where it's like if he'd taken the piss 5% less, right? The situation could be entirely different.
I'll tell you what would make it different from his behavior. Yes, taking the piss, definitely. I think the key thing that led to this for him is not being an utter shit to every single person you work with, right? You started the program by saying I'm hated more than what by one particular individual. Well, I tell you what, everyone I've ever spoken to who worked for him has said the same thing about him. You know, I got off the phone with someone who I spoke to, a source, and the first thing he said to me was, I don't hate anyone in the world other than Liam Kavanagh. And that was a response. kind of everyone I spoke to had the same stories. He's someone who, you know, if he had just treated the people he worked with a little bit better, shown them some of the kind of, you know, they say at the time they didn't know that what he was doing was unlawful. They just, you know, he didn't really, wasn't clear about his business. But he, you know, he splashed the cash for himself. He would sack people at the slightest, slightest provocation. Scream and shout at people if you didn't get the right sandwich on his jet or whatever it was. All of these things add up over the years to create, these people who are willing eventually, despite being under, you know, non-disclosure agreements, to speak to journalists. And just a little bit of respect, a little bit of politeness, and a lot of this stuff doesn't come to light.
I don't have to deal with this. I'm going to go work for Jimmy Kimmel.
it's interesting though, because we have this idea sometimes of like the catch me if you can kind of like debonair like fraudster, right? In this case, allegedly, it really does seem like no. Instead, he would much rather have like lived out this kind of it's not even a fantasy because he had the things, but this kind of like this lifestyle. And then also be a dick about it to everyone around him, which is like, that's the kind of thing that you see replicated all the way up, you know? And that's the thing that I think that you can get him on, like, emulating people, you know?
You know who you see do that is, this is just why people keep betraying Donald Trump, because he would be like, oh, I'm not going to pay my lawyer, of course. Never.
Yeah, I expect you to, like, go to prison for me. Also, I am not going to pay you.
He's a very bad lawyer. Why would I pay him? Have you seen him recently? He's bleeding his own skin. It makes no sense. No sense at all.
I know we sort of mentioned also that this is one of the less consequential things about it, other than to hit, you know, his sort of like personal downfall, if it even can be called a downfall. But can we talk about the Instagram account? Because I think it's like fun, at least.
Yeah. You should say that the Instagram account that he denies having any involvement in.
Someone's Instagram account that seems to have an unusual level of access coincident with the activities of Liam Kavanagh.
That's my ass.
No, look, it was created by a tattoo artist he knows. Without his knowledge.
No further questions.
Well, that's how he had access to his ass.
So the Instagram account was called Secret Billionaire 777.
And it I hate when this happens. I have a tattoo, right? And when I went in, the tattoo artist was like, do you want me to create you a secret Instagram account where I document everything about your lifestyle? I was like, no. But like, had I not been paying attention in that moment, I could have easily fallen into this situation.
I like also that he's not actually a billionaire, so it's kind of aspirational.
Yeah, that's a good point.
But that's where it is a fantasy. That's genuinely where it is where, you know, you take this money and you go to Dubai, you're $135 million or pounds or whatever, where $135 million is nothing to a lot of the people there. Mm. And you just kind of like post, I guess, or hang out in bars. I don't know. What do you do at that point?
So I'll tell you some of the, this is just from your article, Gareth. You can tell me any more just to set us off. But posts on the Instagram account included a customized Lamborghini Aventador done by a YouTuber.
That's cursed. The philosophy tube Lamborghini.
A Damien Hirst sculpture. Private jets, jeweled Hublots, guns, yachts, an estate in Hampshire.
Did he have an original Dean Koontz?
Well, he's going to make a new one.
Yeah.
And also, he bought, and I raised an eyebrow at this, that he bought and redecorated a flat in Bucharest, Romania, including a £240,000 spend on 25 TVs combined into a huge screen, and £250,000 in a rotating bed so large a crane had to install it.
I'm sorry, combined 25 TVs into a huge... But, like, you can buy very big TVs, like, and it's an apartment, right?
Get a projector, even.
How big? I don't understand how a screen could be so big that it required 25 separate TVs to construct, but also fit inside an apartment.
Small TVs. What if they're really small TVs?
Yeah, they're like 20-inch TVs.
No, but buying and renovating a luxury flat in Bucharest with a rotating bed.
Yeah, I mean,
I don't know. Where did Andrew and Tristan Tate live again? Just asking questions, unrelated questions.
So let's talk a little bit about like the lifestyle and how he sort of the lifestyle of sort of consumption, but also something he said really got to me, which was, "I'm going to start a family office and create generational wealth." So let's talk a little
class
bit about
mobility. That. It's real for this one guy.
Mm.
I mean, that was his plan all along, as the as the email states. It's as you said, kind of make money while the sun shines, literally, and then bugger off and transcend into this the fuckosphere and be untouchable. I think like the interesting thing about one of the interesting things about the Instagram account was that actually at the time those things that he's photographing, he doesn't own any of those things. This lifestyle he's portraying, this is actually before he gets when he gets these big injections of cash, not to buy the solar farms, but to like just increase the investment in a particular kind of portfolio of them. And then the council is basically handing him £50 million at a time, basically no questions asked. Then he starts, creates through his tattoo artist, creates an Instagram account, appears with photographs of his house that he had nothing to do with, of course. But these objects, you know, that he doesn't actually own yet. I mean, he kind of goes on to buy a jet for himself, and the jet pictured is a chartered one. He goes on to get all this kind of bling, but so much of the stuff there is actually kind of something he's trying to project that he wants. It's
a rented Hublot. It's got to go back to the store at the end.
Manifesting it, yeah.
Yeah, and this is the.
That's like we have a whole massive industry in this country of selling that exact kind of aspiration, right? Like you have people on TikTok doing the same thing. This was part of Andrew Tate's deal too. Was like posing in front of cars, and before he owned those cars, he was posing in front of like cars that still had the like dealership sticker in the window. It works for some of them.
Shooting Andrew Tate out of the Lamborghini dealership near Luton with a broom. He's in here again. Fuck off.
I guarantee you a Lamborghini dealer in somewhere around the Environs has done that at some point in their life.
The Environs of Luton is a very cursed phrase.
The Environs. Yeah. The biome. I don't know. Mm.
We talk about also like this lavish lifestyle, his I'd say attitude towards people, his extraordinarily antisocial, not just because of what he did to Thurrock, but just interpersonally
yeah,
also.
Bought a Hublot. Like, yeah.
And but it's also we can say, right? Like,
sorry, it's very patrician of me.
This is the, but this is the kind of economic winner that was created out of basically the transition to Thatcherism. This idea that that the only way to win is to be a shark, and only suckers do actual things. What you need to do is you need to middleman, and you need to sell confidence. That or weapons to the Saudis, basically, were sort of the two games left in town.
He's Britain's answer to Yevgeny Prigozhin, you know?
He turned
his custom philosophy tube Lamborghini on London and is leading a march of property developers.
Yeah, like, this is the British style of oligarch. Rather than becoming rich, trading Levi's for Rosneft shares.
Selling hot dogs to the Russian army or whatever, yeah.
Rather than doing that, you just understand that with an increasingly cash-strapped government is desperate for fixes to its problems, and it's just going to turn on the spigot for you if you're charming and convincing enough, or not even charming enough, if you just seem like you will be a shark on their behalf and make someone else lose. That's really sort of what we're left with, and that's that kind of alienation that is that is required for capitalism in general, but especially financialized capitalism. That is. Those in whom it lives, if it lives in your heart, right, that sort of emptiness, that emptiness that desires domination of rather than connection with other people, then yeah, you are going to be the perfect economic actor. We have created that man as a winner through the transformations in the country of the 1980s.
So what you're saying is it really is like hustle mindset. All along, it's just that the hustle mindset kind of makes you a vampire.
It's well, essentially, yes.
I had to grind for this view.
you could ask, right?
Wow, Lamborghini, two Lamborghinis.
So you can ask, right? How is Rockfire that different from G4S or Capita?
I mean, he did move to Romania.
Yeah.
Right. Look at the size of my TV.
Yeah, I'm sorry, Gareth. You've come on the wrong podcast.
The question really I have is how is Rockfire different from something like Capita or G4S or Carillion? Again, massive beneficiaries, for example, of PFI contracts, whose executives also probably live quite lavish lifestyles. They might be a bit more genteel than Liam Kavanaugh. They might be like, I don't know, better educated. But the difference really is, I think that Liam Kavanaugh takes the piss more, essentially.
Yeah, yeah. He lacks the kind of like upper British social classes acumen to kind of like cover his tracks in the deft ways that the people at the top of those do. And I mean, look, and to be fair to Carillion, you know, Riding Dirty was a tune.
So as a Gareth, how does that strike you as an idea?
I mean, you put it better than I would. I've been writing about the guy for so long, but not in those, you know, just don't think as a journalist in those terms quite often. It's the way you've put it he's a product of, to me, he's always been a product of austerity and the kind of pressure placed on local government to make ends meet, to still make sure that you know, vulnerable kids and adults get the social care that they need, whilst also being bled dry of every single other option. And there's bound to be, like you said, there's a wider kind of trend towards these individuals who know that they can basically, you know, make a huge amount of money through very little work of their own. And those two things, when you've got, you know, combined with, you know, councils are completely underqualified and unable, or, you know, in some cases unwilling to like ask the difficult questions. That yeah, I mean. Again, I'm not able to put it quite as eloquently as you are.
Well, so let's move on a little bit. Just the last thing about Kavanaugh before we sort of end on Thurrock and how they're doing. Where's Kavanaugh now? Is he holed up in his house in Hampshire? Is he in Dubai? Is he in Bucharest?
He's in his castle in Transylvania.
Yeah. You've said
he
right,
sleeps a deathless sleep.
You've said, right, following our first story in 2020, Kavanaugh was caught in a dash cam planning more drastic action. Again, I guess we know how he was caught, right?
Because, well, see, that's how you know he's not a vampire, because he shows up on a dash cam.
But we know how he was caught because he's such a piece of shit that people can't stop leaking about him.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, if you're a local council, you have to invite him in first, and the trick is to not do so.
It says, while being driven to an airport in Bournemouth to board his jet, he spoke of the need to document things in order to protect everyone's interest in the money. Now, a bomb got dropped with this fucking article shit, but I'm not bothered now. I'm never going to raise a pound from a local authority ever again. And then began to confirm the process of deregistering his companies had started, saying, get that done. Get shit transferred over. Get rid of fucking Rockfire now. Get rid of all this other bullshit. So after he realized that, like, the dime was dropped and that people knew what he was doing, like, where did he go? What's he up to now? Where is he?
So that's in discussing the process of restructuring his businesses in order to allegedly hide, what he'd been doing with Thorek's money. Eventually, he leaves, basically out of the country for most of the time. He went to live in Dubai.
The first refuge of a scoundrel.
when the council, for example, are inclined to finally catch up with him, by that point, he's sold that property in Dubai. He's already kind of sold the jet, likely flogged the super yacht as well. So I think that question of where he is, that's been troubling me for several months, troubling the council, I think, as well, as they're trying to, I understand, file papers on him, as they should have done possibly several years ago. Mm-hmm. He's certainly not trying to sue us, which is something that he's notoriously litigious. He goes after people who speak out about him. We've obviously written a very, very, very strongly worded article recently and haven't heard from him since. I think he's keeping his head down, probably quite sensibly, trying to avoid any further attention.
Gareth's just getting BBC News'd by a very cute child.
Yeah,
yeah. I was going to say,
it's one of the most delightful interruptions we've had, actually.
Yeah,
cute child covered in chocolate ice cream. It looks like,
as they should be.
It must also be like tremendously satisfying as a journalist, just on a personal level, to have the sort of target of an investigation on audio going, "Oh, this guy has ruined me" in an entirely justified way. You know?
Yeah, it was. It remains, one of my favorite things from a story I've ever done, I think.
I think it would be very funny if Liam Kavanagh just shows up in Mayendorf Castle with, like, Gerard Depardieu, Edward Snowden, Jan Marsalek.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, this is kind of now like a Crime Watch appeal. You know, have you seen this man?
Alleged Crime Watch. It's an alleged Crime Watch.
Have you allegedly seen this alleged man? Yeah.
I'd like to thank Jan Marsalek, who at my darkest moment let me come and live in his barrel.
There is something like quite interesting about media as well, just in the sense of it, like, it's taken, like, and I do wonder whether, like, the lack of, like, a local press, especially, well, like, in places like Thurrock, and, you know, where you don't, whether, if it's anything like the neighbouring parts of Kent, where I'm more familiar with, you don't really have much of a local press that kind of has the capability and resources to look into something like this. And I do wonder whether some of this guy's, like, reactions to your investigation, like, how much of that do you think kind of comes as a result of just not even expecting to be investigated because there isn't really an infrastructure that's ever really done it? Like, you know, even papers like that are kind of better funded, the amount of kind of time and resources that they have to kind of cover council meetings and to cover, like, what's actually going on in terms of local politics is so diminished that I wonder whether kind of, yeah, I wonder what the relationship is between councils kind of like taking these, like, do, or councils like Thurrock, like, doing this type of stuff on the basis that there isn't really like a mechanism of oversight, and this broader kind of result, then the resultantly just like disconnection from local communities in terms of like how their local authorities are even sort of governed in the first place.
Yeah, I mean, I could wax lyrical for probably hours about the decline of local journalism because that's my background. You've mentioned Croydon a few times. I wrote about Croydon, reported on Croydon for about 10 years. And the same's happened there. That story's repeated across the country. You know, there's undoubtedly, this went on, much longer than it would have done because of, the terrible state of the local press. You know, there's a guy who runs a hyperlocal blog there, but there was no journalist in the traditional media in those meetings, looking through those reports, checking the accounts, putting the freedom of information requests in, asking the tough questions, holding the council's feet to the fire and saying, look, you're crowing about how good these things are, but I've looked into this and this rings alarm bells just from my cursory understanding of how this stuff should work. And that is repeated across the country. There are some very hardworking, diligent local journalists out there, but they are, hugely up against it. They work in an industry that's obsessed with, clicks and shareable content, driving outrage on social media and desperately chasing Tesco's advertising pounds, and not doing the digging, the investment in the time and resources it takes. And it is bloody hard. I've been working on this since October 2019. And it was a hard sell for work from where I work, and we do investigative work because, councils aren't sexy. They don't, people tend to switch off when you talk about them. But, the other stuff you've seen in Croydon, you've seen it in Woking, you see it in Slough, stuff is going on in Birmingham. All this stuff is indicative not just of the kind of shit financial situation that local authorities are in and the risk they're being forced into taking, but the lack of transparency and they're wanting to hide this stuff and the lack of challenge from the good local press when it happens. And it will happen again. Loopholes have been closed, but there'll be new ones because vulnerable kids, disabled adults, all these things, all these people still need help lawfully. They still need to be, all these services need to be paid for. And there doesn't appear to be any political will on both sides, from any side to sort this out. The only option is to keep relying on the councils to make the hard decisions, because it's easier to push it onto them than it is to recognise this whole system's broken. It needs proper funding.
If you need to fund care for the disabled and you need help and you can find him, maybe you can hire the Lamborghini vampire.
So I want to talk, before we end, I want to talk a little bit just about the fallout on Thurrock, where we're saying that one local resident was quoted as saying, "We're lucky if our bins are emptied at the moment at all on our road, and my council tax is already £2,000 a year. And they've actually stopped collecting all garden waste bins. The bins.
British politics, it all comes back to bins eventually.
Yeah, once they come for the bins, that's when the people are on the fucking streets. I'll tell you that.
Yeah.
Schools collapsing is one thing, but the bins.
But that also includes increases. They've cut buses, regional buses that now have left lots of, especially elderly residents of towns around Thurrock with no way to get into the city to go to things like doctor's appointments. Literally just no way. You just can't go now. You either have to get a taxi, which you can't afford, or just be like, well, okay, I suppose that's just a doctor's office I won't be going to. It now costs more to get buried or have your ashes interned. It costs more to get married.
Oh, that's can't die, I can't afford it.
Yeah, no, that's really grim.
Also,
historic cycle of samsara, where you're trapped in this life until you've earned enough money to die.
The carers and community nurses for NHS now cost £150 a year instead of £120 for hospitals. Thameside Theatre is likely to close, although performance charges are also up. And so basically what has happened is...
Yeah, it's more expensive. It's also closed.
Liam Kavanagh has essentially had a whip round Thurrock and taken a few hundred quid from everybody, and that's sort of it. And now he has like a private jet made of few blows.
You can consolidate that into one private jet,
Yeah. That's essentially looks like the picture, which is low. And we haven't even seen the cuts to the services really truly begin in Thurrock. This is just beginnings.
Exactly. That's just
it's just the start.
Skimming the surface. We're talking decades. What's more likely to happen, I think, is that Thurrock as a council just won't exist anymore. They'll just have to delete it and reboot, and it'll become the District of Essex. And at some point down the line, a decision maker will, give the okay to writing this whole thing off, They'll quietly drop the case, if there ever will be a case, or an attempt to get some of this money back. Because ultimately, this is all, for a long time, this has been about, it's been about reputation and about not wanting to prolong the embarrassment of the local authority and by extension, the Conservative government, because it's a Tory local authority. So, yeah, I think it's an incredibly bleak future. And, you know, they say lessons have been learned. They're going to tell people, but that what you've outlined there, they've not really been clear about what you've said there either. That's kind of piecing together bits and pieces of stuff that's come out in kind of obscure government report, council reports that no one reads. They're still withholding information, despite everything that's happened, about, you know, how this is actually going to affect people, and ultimately, well, the people are going to pay the price for Kavanagh's jet, his, you know, Hublot watch, his crystal chandeliers and his rotating bed are, you know, the people of Thurrock, basically.
And further, right, you know, this is, we say lessons will be learned, but funding for local authorities is only decreasing relative to the services that they're going to need to provide.
But don't worry, I'm sure Keir Starmer's committed to changing that, right?
So the gambling
I think
is...
everyone in Thurrock should get to wear the Hublot watch for a day and have a go on the rotating bed. I think that's a fairer solution and the right one for the people of Thurrock.
Yeah, that this is the gambling is unlikely. The gambling is only going to increase because you're left with no option but to put it all on red. That's it. You have statutory obligations that with you have no funding. And you're either going to waste all of that time on magic solutions that you're going to be able to say, we have fulfilled our statutory obligations by, I don't know, replacing classes for, like, you know, disabled kids with like a Skype call or a video. You can say, oh, yeah, we've
a picture of a Hublot watch.
Yeah, we've done, because you can do the classic.
The most swagged out disabled kids in Southeast England.
This is a lot of how British government operates as well, is by changing the definitions of things to say that they've complied with their requirements, but so they can get by another day without spending money. They can keep the plate spinning. So it's either that or gambling. That's the only two ways I can see British local authorities coping with the increased pressures put on them. So have lessons been learned from the Thurrock debacle? The only real lesson to learn from the Thurrock debacle is that if you are someone who is willing to, I don't know, inflate the value of a solar farm or whatever, you can probably make generational wealth in the next 10 years before they just run out of money entirely.
It's one of the few ways left of doing that. I mean, I joke about him being a vampire, but he has just like destroyed an entire town. So,
but you know, no one as patrician as Count Dracula would ever buy something as gauche as a Hublot. So. On some level, perhaps he's not.
Also, difficult for a vampire to get into the solar farm business.
That's a tough one. I'll be expecting it at night.
Yeah, that's very true.
So I think that's probably the place to leave it. Gareth, any final views on the sort of cobra and mongoose battle that you've been waging with Liam Cavill? I guess he's a cobra with tens of thousands of mongooses because everyone fucking hates him. But what, any words on the sort of your ongoing eternal combat with this man?
Sorry, you were torturing that metaphor at a CIA black site, pouring, you know, you're pulling out its fingernails, pouring water over its face.
Sorry. What next for sort of your eternal combat with Liam Cavanagh, Gareth?
I mean, I'd like to think after, almost 4 years of working on this story and investigating this, it might be time for the authorities to take over and actually do something.
It might be nice.
Well, in Britain?
Yeah, I don't have a whole much faith. I've probably written about, if I could, been a journalist for about 15 years, I can probably count on one hand the number of times the authorities have done something. But it would be nice if someone, whether that was, you know, the police, Serious Fraud Office, HMRC, God forbid, Thurrock Council, you know, actually try and get some of this money back. You know, I'm not making a comment about guilty otherwise, responsible or not. I just think that owe it to people, owe it to me, because I've taken so much of my life doing this, to actually try. And actually maybe set an example that, you know, people might see that you can't get away with doing stuff like this. And it kind of counters some of the stuff I think you quite fairly pointed out. I won't hold my breath, unfortunately.
No.
Indeed. Well, Gareth, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to come and talk to us today. It's been a very interesting, if depressing, conversation.
Super informative. I've learned a lot about a new type of guy.
Yeah, the Lamborghini vampire, or as they would call him in Australia, the Lambo vampire.
I want to thank you, the listener, for listening. Mm. If you like this show, as you know, there is a Patreon, $5 a month.
We've got a solar farm you can buy.
we're crossing out the big oil warehouse, NFT, bargain bin, last resort, tax laws, harvesting center. Mm. We're now putting solar farm on the big list of businesses that we're also considering being.
Yeah.
I want to thank you for listening. You can subscribe to the Patreon if we're still doing that and not becoming a solar farm.
Yeah.
It would be a second episode a month, second episode a week, every week for $5 a month. It's very hot and I'm real stupid because of it. Mm. There are other episodes. There's Left on Red. There's Britnology. There's the stream. You know it. Mm. You've been there. I don't think we have any other live stuff coming up to plug, Milo. You're the keeper of that kind of knowledge.
Not for a minute. There'll probably be a live show later in autumn or early winter, I suspect.
Maybe like we could do a Christmas one. What about that?
Oh, yeah, there you go.
Yeah, a very TF Christmas.
Yeah, the festive Lamborghini. Yeah.
Yeah. We'll all pull up in our festive Lamborghinis and be like, please, you all need to upgrade your Patreon. Yeah.
You've heard about the Turkish Ferrari. Now hear about the festive Lamborghini.
All right. Anyway, we've wasted enough of this actual legitimate journalist's time. So thank you very much again, Gareth. Thank you very much to listeners. And we will see you on the bonus episode in just a few short days.
Bye-bye. Bye,
everyone.
Bye. Bye.